Like all the controls on this remote unit, the volume is fully variable. Should the telephone ring or guests arrive,
let me, after all this, do the introduction. Pleased to welcome Professor Maithan from University College London and also Extreme Everest. And you have, your resume is quite long, but the coolest thing is for us probably the engagement in Extreme Everest. I guess that you've been on top of Mount Everest.
I've not been to the top.
Yeah, not been to the top.
I've lived out there for 6 months in total, so
okay.
2-3 month stints.
So, very impressive. And now you're here to do a resident seminar. And these are some of the residents of Karolinska in Solna. And then on the screen you have the residents in Huddinge, also Karolinska. And I hope they can hear you through the telephone. Can you hear me loud and clear? So-and-so? Okay. So we also have a problem with the screen.
But apart from that, it's all going well.
But
lunch was nice.
So Professor Maithan is going to have a chat with us without any screen to help him. And of course, you can ask questions and talk to us through the telephone. Very nice. And the best part is that Professor Eriksson introduced me as the digital whiz or something.
Yeah, something like that, yeah. I'd hate to see what the bad ones are like.
Please, go ahead.
And you said you do some podcasting as well, is that right?
Yes.
And how's all that going?
Well, the sound is terrible.
Nice.
This is going to be our best so far.
So, for those you can probably see here, that's one of the things I got into in the last year was I've run this thing called evidence-based perioperative medicine for 20 years, which is a not-for-profit. It's a charity, and it now has meetings in the USA and in Hong Kong and Singapore and Australia, but the original one was in Ireland and then in London. And about a year ago, I was getting a bit irritated by how many meetings we have that are just a few people in a room. So we started podcasting, and we put out a podcast every day. It's all completely free under the guise of Top Med Talk, TopMedTalk. So for the last few weekends, there's been a series about Everest, TopMedTalk. For the last week, there's been a series about fluid matters, so perioperative fluid management. We were hoping to have 10,000 downloads this year, and we've had 130,000 downloads so far in 130 countries. So it's very popular, and every state in the USA was listening, with the exception of somewhere called South Dakota recently. And I wanted,
never heard.
So I wanted to know what went on in South Dakota, because it was it was making the map look really good, because it was the only place. You can call up the statistics and you can see all your listeners, and it was empty. And then I was just building up to a presentation where that was going to be one of my gags, and someone started listening in South Dakota, so they ruined it. So it's got the whole of the USA now. Anyway, that's all quite good fun. So if you want to, the stuff I'm going to talk about, if you want to hear about that. So where are you all with enhanced surgical recovery?
In what sense?
Is it completely, the principles of enhanced recovery, is it completely normal in all forms of surgery? I.e. is, you know, no one's getting nil by mouth beforehand, everyone's getting prehabilitated, everyone's drinking, eating, mobilizing within 24 hours, everyone's home within 3 days. You know, the sort of classical...
Not in this hospital.
Okay. Well, why, out of interest?
I don't know.
Good question.
I think our excuse has been that our patients are so complicated.
Yeah, that was our excuse too. So we... So I'm sure you know, I've heard of Professor Henrik Kellett, who is the surgeon from Copenhagen, maybe that's the reason, in Denmark, who started enhanced recovery, or published first about it about 20 years ago. and we all used to listen to him talking about the how enhanced recovery happens and the four main pillars of it, you know, the patient education, fluid management, pain management, and in particular getting people drinking, eating and mobilizing immediately post-operatively. And that was first published in the British Journal of Anesthesia in 1997. And it's interesting that as a surgeon, he couldn't get it published in a surgical journal because it was all about perioperative medicine, basically. It was all about pain relief and nutrition and exercise and health and well-being and fluid management. The next publication was in the British Medical Journal in 2001. Then there was a, in 2001 from the USA, is that not working for them? There was changing phone. Hello, folks. I'm not saying anything interesting anyway. The sort of complex surgical patients were published by Connor Delaney and Tony Senegor from the USA, saying the most complicated patients are the ones that get the greatest benefit from the enhanced recovery principles. So there's a few slides going over at this end with some publications on it. So in 2009 in the UK, I was between mountains. So I'd come back from our first Everest expedition. And prior to going into our second Everest expedition, I was approached to take a national leadership role to see if we could rapidly spread enhanced recovery principles through the whole of our healthcare system in the UK. At the time, we were saying things like, well, everyone here is much sicker. It's more complicated here. That would never work here. You know, we know we're doing the right thing already. So our government looked at that and said, well, you know, outcomes are a bit shoddy, really. They're a bit ordinary. Morbidity rates are a bit high. Your length of stays are all a bit long. Could you have a look at this enhanced recovery thing and see if it makes a difference? So good thing about being put in charge by the government is you get all the national data and you have the authority to go and have tough conversations with people. So myself and a surgeon, Alan Horgan, were appointed. We looked at all the data and there's a huge variation in length of stay. If we take colorectal surgery, for example, and we take centers doing about 200 cases a year, the length of stay on average was from between 5 days and 18 days. So some institutions, you know, on average, not median, mean, five days length of stay, others 18. Then you'd have places like us, we would turn around and say, well, we're a very big university hospital, like the KI, so we're very, very clever. We really know the right thing to do. Even if you looked at those big centres, our national centres, the length of stay for the people who did the most complex surgery, where the mean length of stay was 6 days, and at the other end of the spectrum, some of the very self-important hospitals, it was over 2 weeks. So when we looked at the ones with a short length of stay, who then we found out had the lowest morbidity rates and had the best cancer survival rates, we looked at what they were doing. They were basically all doing in the enhanced recovery principles. So our national project was to say for colorectal surgery, followed by joint replacement surgery, because there's a lot of them, followed by major cancer gynae surgery and major cancer urology surgery, everyone had to try enhanced recovery. And we, with the backing of the government, we said, you've got to try it within the next 18 months. It's cool to have that authority. So you turn around and say, if in 18 months' time you haven't tried it, now if you've tried it and it didn't work, that's okay. But if you just won't try it, then we don't care who you are, we're not sending you any more surgery. So you can be the Carolina Institute, whatever it is, if you don't try it, you know, Oxford, Cambridge, Imperial, UCL, if you don't try it, no more surgery at government level. And that was highly motivating. So everybody tried it. So within 18 months of starting, 85% of the institutions in the country were doing enhanced recovery. And within 3 years, it became a national standard, such that by April 2012, a declaration was signed in public that said, we now only do enhanced recovery. Now, that may or may not be completely true absolutely everywhere, but the medical students from 2012 onwards only learnt enhanced recovery principles, if you see what I mean. So It's not called that anymore. It's just the new norm. So what do you make about all that then? And by the way, I should say, and all our results got better as well. So our mean length of stay for the whole country went down. Our productivity increased. Our complications reduced. Our cost of care got better. Our patient satisfaction went up. Our readmission rates went down. So anything bad you can think of did not happen. Mm-hmm. Just
does
as
that include all kinds of surgery?
That was the four major sections to begin with. Okay. Then we extended it to all forms of major surgery. Then we extended it to fractured neck of femur and emergency laparotomy. Mm-hmm. And across the board, results have got better. So why don't you do it? I'm being provocative now.
did the hospitals get anything in return?
Because they got better results, increased productivity, so they made more money. So
no, to start with, did they get
no, they just got threatened. Yeah.
Because enhanced recovery also, you have the anaesthetist has to engage in the patient after surgery also, maybe go up to the ward.
Well, our period of engagement afterwards is until this is a new national standard. So I now sit on the Royal College of Anaesthetists, and I'm just finishing my six-year national role for the rollout of perioperative medicine. I'm just coming to the end of that now. We've said that our responsibility ends when the patient is drinking, eating and mobilising. So if you can get them drinking, eating and mobilising in recovery, then you're done. So it's, highly motivating for anaesthesia providers. You know, I'm an anaesthetist primarily. So I'd rather be doing something else, if you see what I mean. So as soon as we've got them drinking, eating, mobilising, we're signed off. And if we look at our outcomes, drink, eat, mobilise is strongly associated with staying well. So if you do drink, eat, mobilise within 24 hours, you tend to get almost no complications and you stay well. If you don't drink, eat, mobilise, you tend to get complications. So it's a very good, in our system, it's a very good surrogate measure.
You have a good acronym for that,
but DREAM. DREAM, yeah, living the dream.
DREAM.
I don't know what that translates to here, but that's living the dream.
Sorry, guys. When we pose questions, we need to speak up a little bit so the friends in hooding hear us.
And they can also ask questions.
Yes. Or can they?
You guys can ask questions too through the phone.
Or make comments. I'm sorry about this, folks.
No, it's not.
So increased productivity, quality, patient satisfaction. Any other question? Any questions about that as the principle at the moment? So, I mean, the thing we found hardest initially, and I don't know where you are on this spectrum, is letting people eat and drink till the last minute before surgery. So we've now in paediatrics we've gone to no NPO. So we have there's no starvation period for clears in the children. I don't know what it's like here. And in adults we're still at 2 hours, but we let our patients drink sips of water until they go to theatre. So the idea that they can't come to theatre because they've had something is gone. Where are you on that? Solids is 6 hours is the thing for solids, but we're starting to relax on that as well because it was all made up. I think we made some of it up, our institution, but it's not physiologically sound thought process. You know, starvation leaves you with a slightly higher amount of liquid in your stomach with a lower pH. So it's sort of setting you up for an aspiration pneumonitis, prolonged periods of starvation. Whereas if you drink clears, you're not only, it's got a pH of 7, so you're diluting the content, you also get better gastric clearance. So we have not, anecdotally, I do critical care as well. Get a group of critical care docs together, they haven't seen an aspiration pneumonitis for years. They say, well, where did it go? Why did it disappear? And maybe it's because we've stopped starving people. What do you do here? Do you still have NPO or?
Yeah.
6 hours. 6 hours for everything?
No. Clear liquids until 2 hours.
And do you know what happens in reality? Because our national guidelines said 2 and 6. Whereas when we looked, it was like 12 to 14. Mm. So now we give people drinks, if you see what I mean. We make them drink stuff.
We also have a big problem that elective surgery is stricken from the schedule, and then the patient has kneeled by mouth for 12 to 14 hours, and then they're stricken, and then they're another 12 to 14, and then after like 3-4 days, okay, you can eat something, and then you have to starve again. So that's a big problem, especially in neurosurgery, where we have big problems with the
Yeah, that's one of the big, big changes I think that happened nationally is you get given carbohydrate. Well, you either get nutritional supplementation if you're malnourished, but you definitely get carbohydrate drinks beforehand. And you're given it and told to drink it so that you do come to the operating room hydrated and carb loaded. And post-operatively, in our institution, you get handed a snack box in the recovery area. And there's almost no contraindication to consuming food. Esophagectomy, yes. Whipple's, sort of. There's almost no other major contraindication to it. And you're expecting the people to tuck into their snack box in you know, 1 hour post-extubation. So it's a big difference. And that's part of the motivation to get them drinking, eating, and mobilizing.
And how do the patients react?
They love it. Yep. They love it. Because so the patient satisfaction levels for the enhanced recovery program went up to the highest levels we'd ever recorded by a long way. The main thing is the preparation process is much more detailed because we're about to do something very different from our perspective. We tell the patients everything we're going to do. Whereas before, we didn't think we needed to tell them because we were just doing what we've always done, if you see what I mean. So we then had all these programs where everyone was being fully educated about what happens next, going to surgery school and watching videos and getting program, you know, getting buddies and getting mates. So their satisfaction levels went up because they knew what was going to happen. And then they got greater ownership of that with diaries where they knew that what they had to do next was to sit on the edge of the bed and what they had to do next was to walk around the ward and eat and drink. And so they felt empowered. And they got on with it, which is great. Because there's a lot of them. There's one patient per patient usually, and if 90% of them are doing well, they can look after themselves. And that frees up a lot of manpower, and their relatives can help as well. Don't be scared to challenge me. I'm typically provocative.
I think we only do the recovery on the major abdominal surgery. Yes, some patients, like some. Particular surgery, like hemicolectomies, or I don't know why.
Well, that's where we were.
Start with
and I'm not saying we're right, but that's where we were. Mm-hmm. So it was cherry picking. Mm-hmm. Now, many, many countries are going nationwide now, and the United States is going nationwide enhanced recovery. So the American College of Surgeons in February last year made an announcement whereby it said, according to its pilot data, they demonstrated that everything that we'd found happened there. And they had a government-funded national rollout program from enhanced recovery. So all of the major places are claiming that that's the way they do surgery now.
So we are actually using it in elective surgery, in major abdominal surgery, and urology. I don't know about gynecology. But may I ask you a question about the dam surgery and,
sure.
And the last 200 ml of nutritional drinks?
Yeah.
Following intubation, do you put a nasogastric tube in the patient?
Not really. It depends on the surgery. So
if we are talking about major surgery, about 6 hours planned surgery?
We may do, not necessarily always. No. Depends on the surgery.
Because it's my experience for 10 yeah. years ago when we started in another hospital that the patient came with 200 ml of nutritional drinks, drinking it, we intubate the patient with a nasogastric tube, and suck everything out.
Yeah.
So we're not routinely using nasogastric tube on those patients.
No.
Or when you're, okay.
We would only put a nasogastric tube in if there was an indication.
Indication.
Yeah. So otherwise, no. If people were worried about gastric residual volumes, then increasingly they'd do a gastric ultrasound to see if they had a, you know, if it was a patient who had a history of gastroesophageal reflux disease and possibly a slow gastric emptier, they would sometimes do a gastric scan prior to intubation, mainly for medico-legal purposes, to say that they thought about possible reflux. But I said in intensive care, we have not admitted a reflux pneumonitis for as long as we can remember now. You know, I don't know what happens here again. It's kind of a thing that used to happen a few times a year, and that just doesn't happen anymore. Maybe that's because practice has changed in different ways. But anyone ever seen a reflux pneumonitis? Yeah? No? Yeah?
There's one case I got here. I think that they put the patient on ECMO, finally, because of a big
a big emergency case or a
aspiration. So yeah, emergency.
In that case,
yep.
Previously we was talking about that epidural in major surgery is mandatory. Are you using a lot of epidurals, or are you using morphine or opioids or other ways?
So, Mark, so I was going to say that when people say what are the big ticket items, minimally, apart from patient preparation, which is probably the biggest bit of it, minimally invasive surgery helps. We'd all agree with that. From our perspective, it's the pain management and the fluid management. Because And the pain management is predominantly multimodal, non-opioid or opioid light. So everything about trying to avoid opioid analgesia. And that's become very, very topical in the USA recently, because it would appear that between 5 and 10% of opioid naive people having elective surgery in the United States of America end up as an addict. And their first exposure is what we gave them. Now, it's not that bad in the UK, but
are your epidurals opioid-free?
No. Ours aren't. So our house wine is a dilute bupivacaine, and very dilute fentanyl is our house wine. But epidurals are becoming much less popular. So putting either single-shot spinal plus putting catheters elsewhere, or just putting catheters elsewhere, has become much more popular. Because the collateral side of the epidural is the fluid and hemodynamic management, urinary retention, and tendency for people not to want to mobilize people. So we saw over the duration of the enhanced recovery program that the use of regional analgesia went up, but the use of epidurals went down. The place we still see epidurals used is open surgery in very high-risk patients who are going to intensive care, where the epidural can be completely managed. But we found that our ward use of epidurals, the failure rates were, you know, unacceptably high, which resulted in a greater use of morphine PCAs, which resulted in poor pain management, which resulted in collateral, you know, failure to achieve the goals. So as we used fewer of them in enhanced recovery, things seemed to get better and better.
Is this also the case for abdominal surgery?
Yeah.
Tap
blocks, rectus sheath blocks, the quadratus laborum block is becoming much more fashionable at the moment. Ultrasound-guided tap blocks in the right hands seem to be very good. Rectus sheath seems to be easy for almost anyone to do a good rectus sheath block. So increasingly surgeons are doing laparoscopically guided blocks more than they used to do before. But many of the lap surgery is non-regional, non-opioid now as well. It's just, you know, more low-dose ketamine, more gabapentinoids, regular acetaminophen, non-steroidals, magnesium.
How do you collect all this data? What does your quality registers look like?
So nationally, we have what are called hospital episode statistics, and that's an ICD-10 coded national system, which really drives our internal billing process. So we have to code everything to recover the money from the government. We're a national health system. And that's all publicly available, so we can access those data sets. So that will give you comorbidities, length of stay, dead alive, readmissions, major complications, but it's now starting to get fairly blunt by the time you get into the granular detail. You can detect things like new acute kidney injury, but you can't get right down to what type of infection, etc. So that's then much more dependent on institutional data sets. We can do linkage then with our general practitioners, so we can do longitudinal, as you can hear. We can do longitudinal cohorts, and we can link that to pre-morbid databases. So that allows us to do our long-term follow-up of then emergency laparotomies, for example, where we have 100% coverage with a regular rolling report for emergency laparotomies, including long-term follow-up. We're just about to get a complete electronic health record. Not everyone's happy about that because it's incredibly expensive. So we're getting the system EPIC, which is so we will have all the information about all of our patients available in a computer that we can't necessarily get into. if you see what I mean. But it'll all be there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you have cases where the surgeon or you yourself say, this is not a case for early recovery? This is has to be done the traditional way, Nirvana.
So the mantra is that that pathways are surgery specific. They're never surgeon specific. That was a big change. And that's a big challenge in America at the moment. That was a big, big difference. What we're there to do is to adapt the pathway to the patient's needs. So never the provider's needs, never the anaesthetist's quirks, never the surgeon's quirks. It's adapted to the patient. And about 15% need pathway adaptation. And in certain circumstances, being nil by mouth preoperatively will be indicated, but not very often. But it's not surgeon A likes it this way and surgeon B likes it this way and surgeon C likes it that way. That was Henrik Kellett's first line in his first publication. How can that possibly be true? You know, how can that possibly be true? Do I need a different transfusion trigger because of the way I hold my scalpel? It cannot be true. So that was really challenging. I've got lots of holes in my back. But luckily I had a surgeon with me, so he...
I think that's a big problem maybe in the States. So maybe
they're changing...
Than in Sweden.
Yeah, the United States has been a very, very big problem, but they're changing quite quickly now. Mm. I think they're changing quite quickly because of the publication, the named surgeon publication of results. I mean, we're getting into... We've had that for a while. You can look up on databases. We're getting into now named team results. So if you're the lead anesthesia anesthetist for a particular type of surgery, then not only does it say surgeon, it says your name too. Now, I don't know where you are on that journey, but our surgeons were initially worried that it would mean that patients would shop around, you know, for, and it turns out that they don't tend to. They tend to go to the place where the family's always gone, where the parking is convenient, where the coffee's free, whatever it is, but the fact that you're five times more likely to die doesn't seem to factor into it, apart from a few people. And the parking's easy and it's where the family's always gone, because they don't believe that, it, you know, they know the hospital at the end of the road is really good, they don't believe the results that say it's not very good. What it motivates is the practitioners, because when you sat down at Christmas dinner as the surgeon in the family, you liked the fact that everyone knew you were the best surgeon in the country. Now, when the league tables came out and it came that you weren't the worst, you were the second to worst surgeon in the country, you were highly, highly motivated to either make sure the data was right or to fix that, because you've suddenly gone from hero to zero in front of your friends and family. Because, you know, you've been, 15 years they've been believing you're the best doc in the world. They get your scorecard and it turns out your bottom quarter, that's highly motivating. Now, if it's not risk adjusted in your bottom quarter because you're doing the only person who's prepared to accept the redo, you know, triple valve replacements, then people understand that. But if it's for, you know, primary joint replacements, first time CABG, etc., it's highly motivating. And that really did tighten our results up. And then it brings in, because then the surgeons turn around and say, I can't do this surgery any better. I've checked. People have come to visit me. And they tell me that I'm doing this fine. You're all letting me down. Because you're drowning the patients or desiccating the patients or your epidurals don't work or you're using a morphine PCA or you're starving the patient. And then we say, oh, okay, you know, let's have a look at that. And then, so when your name's on it as well, you start to get interested in that. Because we all know we're the best, don't we? Well, one of the best, aren't we? True? You know what I mean? None of us go around thinking we're the worst.
No.
We might think we're not necessarily the best, because we think that you're the best or whatever it is, but we don't think we're the worst.
We have the best AP.
Yeah, you do. No, we've got the same one. It's why I've been laughing.
So if we were to do the same journey with the nationwide early recovery, what would be your recommendations and what do you think are the biggest hurdles?
Culture it's always culture eats everything for breakfast. And cultural challenges are greatest in the most magnificent institutions. So I work in an ivory tower. You know, it's allegedly very good. We think we're great. Very, very hard to change those places culturally. Very difficult. The smaller hospitals that are university associated, where the management is very close to the bedside, change much more rapidly. Now, if you then publicize that, then the ivory towers will not accept that as being the truth. They will not accept the fact that the 200-bedded hospital down the road that no one's heard of is better than University College London. So we catch up rapidly after that. But culture is the biggest challenge. So it takes leadership, that's really what it comes down to. And belief.
They actually have a national wide URS system, but it's don't have the same tooth that you are talking about, that during 18 months change it or you are not going to receive any money.
Yeah.
And you are actually nationally inspectors for different departments to look at how well they are using it. But how it does work, I can't say anything about that.
So we've settled on the end because when we finished the program, we had a change of government and they took their foot off the gas. So they were much less interested in publishing results because they had planned to reduce the expenditure on healthcare. So you know if you do that, things will get worse. So if you don't know the truth, you don't have to deny the truth. So it's best just not to know the truth. So that's what we did. Then they've re-looked at the truth and it turns out that our results have slipped in some places. So they've reinvigorated the whole thing and now they've gone for a very simple objective. It's just that 90% of patients should be drinking, eating and mobilizing within 24 hours of major surgery. Very simple. Because if you have that objective, then you're either achieving it or not. Yeah. Now, we all can think of some forms of surgery where that's not possible, but it's pretty rare. You know, so that's very motivating for everybody. So our major surgery, major thoracic unit, and we all know thoracics, it makes a big difference. If everyone's not out of bed having breakfast the following morning, it can only be because they've got multiple organ failure, if you see what I mean. The ward round's relatively easy. Hello, 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 oh, hello, hello, hello. Better go see the one in bed, but if you see what I mean. Because if they're not, the nurses are really, really disappointed. They really feel as though they've let you down there if the patient's not sitting out of bed having breakfast.
What do you think should be the ultimate driving force behind enhanced recovery? The surgeon or the anesthesiologist? Or should it be a joint venture?
So the surgeon's got to want it. And sometimes they very successfully drive it, but that seems to be quite rare. But I think they're much better at being the sort of captain who spends a lot of time in their bedroom making notes, and the officer on the deck is often much more successfully either anesthesia or nursing. It can be a physiotherapist, nutritionist, whatever it is, but it's usually somebody has some degree of authority with the confidence of the surgeon that goes across the extended pathway. So nurses are great at it if they're given enough authority, because they're very good at managing all the different personalities and getting, most of the hard work has to be done by the nurses. That's the big change.
Irin Sunen is a surgeon, he's professor of the unit.
Yep.
In KI, you know where?
He's the president of the IRAS Society.
Yes, yeah. He's the president.
They've got to change their working patterns because they can't go through the day getting everybody out sequentially, such that you might not get mobilized until 6 o'clock in the evening. So they've got to put a lot more workforce into the first couple of hours in the day to get everyone, you know, out of bed and going. So you need a lot more nursing assistance from that perspective, but not for very long in the day. You know. And then they can shift on to the next zone and mobilise the people that were done late the following evening. Mm. but you typically decrease your total number of practitioners because a lot more people are drinking, eating, mobilizing, looking after themselves. But you need more people to get them out of bed. Every major surgical patient needs two people to get them out of bed safely.
What they did 15 years ago with Ulle Ljungqvist, they had a team. They moved from hospital to other hospitals and educate people.
Yep.
From surgeons and anesthetists to the ward nurses and everybody. And they launched even drinks and everything included. It was a package. With education, drinks, foods, and
some.
So they launched it in Sweden, starting with university hospitals. I think it was 15 years ago.
And that's when various different products come into play. That's when fights start because people start to turn around. So you're selling me the drink, or you're making me use one particular type of drug. So we went very much. No, we're not. Nationally, we said principles, and then what you do against each one of those principles is for you to decide. You should let people drink beforehand, and you should ideally let them have some degree of carbohydrate load. How you do that is up to you. Your national results of the collective, ERAS collective, is quite impressive.
Yes.
So you've produced quite a lot of the literature nationally about it.
I think in Stockholm, Ersta and St. Göran.
All of hospitals are using it. All of hospitals are using it. We are using it actually, depending on. But we are in this hospital, we are not using it. I don't know how it is in Huddinge. Are you using ERAS concept in emergency laparotomy, even in emergencies? Or is it only in implant surgery? Thumbs up, down, in the middle.
ERAS for emergency laparotomy, yes or no?
No, yes, we are here now, yes.
ERAS for fractured neck of femur.
Yes, we are using it.
Fractured neck of femur?
Fracture of the
neck of the femur.
Sorry, our questions are having problems coming through.
Okay.
Okay.
Oh, they came back.
Maybe they're texting them and I'm not looking.
Do you hear us over there now?
Yes.
Yes.
Ah, okay. We identified the microphone.
Step one.
Surgery, no. Only in elective surgeries.
And all elective surgeries?
Only major abdominal surgeries.
Okay.
Program here. So liver, pancreas, esophagus. Basically.
So we realize every now and then that our program against postoperative nausea and vomiting is too old, but we don't tend to do anything about it. Do you have a magic bullet when it comes to...
Drink, eat, mobilize. So ours
that's
are...
the key, no drugs.
We do risk-adjusted regular PONV medication, nothing fancy. So getting a low-dose steroid combined with something like... an ondansetron, for example, would be. Is that one working now? Oh, we've got fold back on the mic. Thank you.
Thank you.
I was going to finish it. So our 20, we have very, very little PONV at 24 hours. We have about 10% in the. Of mild nausea and some vomiting in the recovery area, mm-hmm. but we're close to 0% by 24 hours. Mm-hmm. And most of that seems to be the drink, eat, mobilize bit of it. So being allowed to get some food and get in your belly and get moving around and get your bowels moving has a far greater impact than we'd anticipated. Mm-hmm. So the pharmacological manipulation is being good, but there's a limit to what you can do with that. Sorry, you were going to say?
So what's the next big thing?
Perioperative medicine, which we're into anyway, but there's only so much squeeze you can get out of the enhanced recovery principles, and then what you have to do is you have to fix the patient more. So preoperative anemia, I know you're doing all of this already, but preoperative anemia, the pre-diabetic management, nutrition, exercise, smoking cessation, alcohol reduction, those are the big programs. And cognitive impairment recognition, and mental fitness preparation, resilience. And for the cognitively impaired, the delirium risk, the greater evaluation and preparation of that individual and the importance of getting them back to their own environment, for example. So our post-operative delirium and cognitive impairment rates are going up, not because I think of what we're doing, but because of the population that's coming through. Increasingly, yes. And national exercise programs are being evaluated. As a nation, have become pretty fat and unfit. So making greater inroads and preparing people with active programs to not only identify their levels of fitness, but to intervene to modify that. And particularly in cancer surgery, where people are often shying away from it to say there isn't enough time. Actually, with neoadjuvant chemotherapy, there's a great time opportunity. And we've published a number of interventional studies, and big ones are ongoing now for structured exercise and nutrition programs and mental resilience programs to see if we can help that.
You mentioned that you work in ICU as well.
I do.
Has this work in the perioperative medicine affected your way of looking at principles in ICU as well?
Yeah. Well, I think in parallel, the enhanced recovery in ICU was sort of happening anyway. The mobilization, the early mobilization, the mobilization on ventilations, the mobilization on extracorporeal support has been happening in parallel. And in some places, it's been going faster than enhanced recovery. So, the let's get them, irrespective of the degree of organ support, let's get them up, let's get them going, let's get them moving, including, exercising the muscles of people who are asleep with multiple organ failure is being evaluated all over the world. I'm sure you're doing plenty of work on that here, but so the core principles everywhere seem to be that we as animals would only choose to lie around to get better and not eat for a limited period of time. As soon as we can, we would choose to eat and move, and we've had a bad habit probably of fighting that. In other words, strapping people to the beds and then confining them with drips and drains and drips and tubes and drugs. And
one of the more frustrating things in the ICU is the paralytic ileus, because it
yep.
attenuates its levels of everything.
Yep.
Do you have a magic pill for that?
No. Drink, eat, my life.
Sorry. can you ask the hospital, did you hear the question? No?
Should I rephrase the question?
Paralytic ileus is one of the biggest problems in
the biggest problem, but as an intensivist,
yeah.
I perceive it as a very frustrating problem, because most usually the bowel is not the original organ affected by disease.
Yeah.
But still, it slows everything down.
Absolutely. I think there are two sides of that. There's the iatrogenic ileus, mm-hmm. i.e. treatment related, which we can try and modify pain management, fluid management to change that. Or there is the GI tract that does not want to accept food, that may be the physical manifestation of anorexia, that is the physical manifestation of cellular adaptation, such that you're hibernating. Such that actually you're not going to use food. So even if you stick it in parenterally, it will not get used at a cellular level. And what we call the paralytic ileus is if we were awake, it would be the I'm too sick, I don't want food. It would be our I've got flu anorectic response. Now, ongoing research exploring that to see if the reluctance for the upper GI tract to accept enteral nutrition gives you a mitochondrial signal that is basically I'm now quiescent, I'm not interested in substrate. And the flip side of that is when we do force feed, we seem to be, as you know, we seem to be driving a higher morbidity and mortality rate from force feeding what may be the hibernating patient. So, that's kind of thinking, oh, there you say that, that's a bit challenging. Because, you know, from the enteral, parenteral nutrition literature from the point of view of upping it has been quite disappointing. And the giving less and less seems to be getting more and more strong signal. And then the protein, non-protein balance, ketone diets, you know, muscle autophagy, mitochondrial adaptation, which I'll go into tomorrow from the hypoxia perspective, is looking more intriguing. So, as you say, if the primary problem wasn't the GI tract and we haven't caused ileus, maybe if the stomach says no, we should listen to the stomach. Challenging.
That's my famous last words.
sorry about the AV, guys, and you had to sit through it.
Thank you, Monty, for talking to us. Oh. And thank you, Hödinge, for your patience.
I'll come and say hi tomorrow, I think.
Yes. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.